Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with David Philip Miller about his biography of the 18th century inventor and scientist James Watt, entitled The Life and Legend of James Watt. David, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, By trade, I'm a historian of technology and a historian of science, although I'm retired now, but I still keep working. I originate from Yorkshire, a little town in Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. I was educated at Manchester University as an undergraduate and then at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, where I did my graduate work. And I taught there for a little while and then at the University of Edinburgh. But in way back in 1981, I came to Sydney on a three-year contract. And I've been here ever since. It's a hard place to leave.
You're quite the world traveler. What was it that led you to write a biography of James Watt?
Well, I've been interested in Watt since my undergraduate days when I did a course in economic history at the University of Manchester. And then, of course, I did my PhD in the history of science and technology, and he's always a figure, always someone who crops up. But my early work was more to do with scientific societies and voyages of discovery and so on. But about 20 years ago now, maybe 25, I was working on a Royal Society project, and it struck me that James Watt and his colleagues, the people he worked with, might provide a good example for an argument I was running about the Royal Society. And so I started having a look at his life and gradually got captivated by it. And I've been off and on working on him ever since. I've written a lot of papers. In fact, I've written a couple of other books in which he features. They're not biographies, but the aspects of his work feature very centrally in those books. But about two or three years ago, it struck me that this year it was the 200th anniversary of his death. And I thought maybe I should put all my years of work on him together in a biography, and it might be a biography in the year of his death that might attract a little bit of notice.
It really
so that's
is,
how I came to this book.
It really is fascinating to hear that this project came together in so quickly, given the amount of resources that you had to draw upon for it. I mean, it's an incredibly thorough examination of Watt's life, and as you explained, it was a very diversified life. He was not just active in invention and in science, but as one of the things that I'm sure we'll be getting to later on, he was also very active in the business, and that's one of the misconceptions that you seek to address, which was that he was just a scientist, just an inventor. He really seemed to have a very diverse workload and a very diverse interest. And when I was reading the going back over the endnotes, I was just impressed by the amount of primary source material that you drew together for this.
Yes, well, when people ask me how long it took me to write the book, I do say, you know, 2.5 years or 25. And the 25 refers to the fact that, yes, I mean, you can't make even a small dint in the documentary base for a life of what in really any less time than that. There's an enormous archive of Boulton and Watt papers in Birmingham. And there's lots of other material elsewhere. And as you say, he was such a multifaceted individual. We'll perhaps talk about this, but he was the kind of guy who couldn't keep his finger out of anything. You know, he was your classical improving mentality. He couldn't address any topic without thinking about how it could be dealt with better or improved. And so he led a very varied, very varied existence, which is difficult to come to terms with. And I would still say at this, even at this point, after all that time, that I could still be surprised by things in the Watt archive. I haven't by any means covered everything.
Hmm. One of the things that I found so fascinating when I was reading your book was how far Watt came given the humbleness of his origins. I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a bit about Watt's early life, his family, and how it was that he, you know, got into the business, if you will, of inventing and getting interested in science.
Yes, well, Watt was a Scotsman. He was born in a little town called Greenock, which is just west of Glasgow. He was born in 1736. In Greenock. And he was born, I suppose, to a family who were merchants. We would perhaps call them sort of lower middle class or a business family. Now, his father was a ship's chandler. He supplied provisions for ships. He was also something of a carpenter and a more general merchant. His mother, who came from a family called the Muirheads, represented some rather older family merchant interests, slightly wealthier. So his father married up slightly, I would say. Watt's ancestors were also quite interesting. He had a grandfather who described himself as a professor of mathematics, which really meant that he was a teacher of mathematics. But he also did work for the local town, the local council, that kind of thing. He had an uncle who was a surveyor, produced an interesting map of the Clyde River. And his father, as I say, was a general merchant. So Watt came from a background of people who were technically quite proficient. And Greenock was a place that offered opportunity for people who had those kinds of qualities. It was a relatively newly established town when Watt was born, quite small, maybe about 6,000 population. The population increased by 1,800 to about 20,000, something like that. So it was a small town, but it was rapidly rising. It participated in the Atlantic trade. Because of problems of accessing the upper Clyde, it was difficult for shipping to get right up to Glasgow. And so Greenock, being further down the Clyde River, was more readily accessible. And so it participated in the Atlantic trade, which increasingly involved importing tobacco from the American colonies. And then exporting various goods in return, a lot of sort of household goods and everyday necessities that were exported from Greenock in the Atlantic trade. So the Watts were what were known at the time and are known by historians as improvers. That is to say, they were very much on the side of those in the community who tried to develop economically, develop the town economically. So his father and his grandfather were involved in building local facilities, local churches and local buildings, and served on the council, served in sort of semi-judicial positions and that kind of thing. So that's the sort of background that Watt came from. And in many ways, he was through his life very much like his ancestors as an improver. There's that larger sense of improvement in which you're talking about economic development. But I already mentioned that Watt was also a guy who, you know, with any small problem, he wanted to worry away at it and find a solution. So he was an improver in sort of every sense of the word.
Now, was his interest mainly technical, or did he have any sort of academic bent that he sought to satisfy?
His interests were technical from a very young age. I mean, there are lots of stories, which we have to take with a pinch of salt, I think. There are lots of stories about his youth. He was an avid reader of technical material, chemical texts and the like. And he, although he was schooled at home a lot of the time, he did go to a local grammar school, which provided quite a strong modern education, I suppose they would have described it as, not so much classical education, but concentrating on modern languages, on technical subjects, on mathematics, on business, those kinds of studies. So he was versatile. He also had interests, literary interests, as a youngster and as a grown man later in his life. But yes, there was a very strong technical bias to his experience as a youngster.
So what was it that led him to become an engineer, and how did he embark upon it? I mean, nowadays we think of it as being something that requires higher education, post-secondary education, but the path that you describe is a little bit different.
Yes, indeed. Watt was, in fact, in most ways self-taught. He's what we call an autodidact. It was difficult for his family. His family were not extremely wealthy, which you would need to be in order to be able to spare the time to go to university. And even at university, Watt would not have been able to study engineering as such. It was not something that was in the curriculum in those days. So he took a rather informal route to becoming an engineer. The first thing was he worked for his father. So he worked in his father's mercantile business. And I think in that process, he acquired a lot of business skills and practical skills as well, working with his hands. It was clear to his parents and to people in Glasgow who knew him well that he was a very talented boy. And so they put some thought as to how they might educate him, what he ought to do with himself. And when he was in his late teens, it was decided that he should be apprenticed as a mathematical instrument maker. Now, again, a proper apprenticeship to a mathematical instrument maker would have been a very expensive proposition, even if there were people locally to be found who could do that. And there weren't really, not in Glasgow at that point. So Watt traveled to London as a young man, and he had an informal short apprenticeship with a mathematical instrument maker called John Morgan in London. And this is really where Watt sort of honed a lot of his very fine technical skills, and also where he became aware, I think, of the possibilities of serving scientific circles or natural philosophical operators, as they were called in those days, by offering technical support, you know, with the instruments and so on that were necessary to match scientific experimentation. So Watt went to London in 1755 and stayed there, returned to Glasgow in the year afterwards. And as I say, he learned a great deal there, I think. He was perhaps fortunate in choosing John Morgan. Morgan was not one of the most prominent instrument makers in London. And in a way, it would have been unfortunate if Watt had served his informal apprenticeship with someone more prominent, because the more prominent ones by that time were sort of dividing labor. They were becoming very large-scale businesses, and it's likely that if he'd gone with one of them, he would have spent his days in very repetitive activity, maybe producing measures and so on, very, very, in a very repetitive fashion. But Morgan was a small-scale operator, and as a result of that, Watt was able to do a great many things, learn about a lot of different technical matters. And so he was really quite well prepared when he came back to Glasgow. And he was making instruments to sell initially through his father's business. He was making quadrants, for example, an important navigational instrument of obvious value to, you know, people who were sailing into Greenock and sailing out again. And so that's how he started when he got back to Glasgow. But he gradually moved into his father's mercantile business and had the ambition, I think, at that point to set up himself and to make instruments and to sell them locally. The next big opportunity for him really was also connected with his instrument making skills. He knew some people connected with the University of Glasgow. In fact, one of his relatives on his mother's side, a chap called George Muirhead, was a professor at the University of Glasgow. I mentioned that the Muirheads were slightly more elevated socially than the Watts were. And through George Muirhead and one or two other contacts at the university, Watt was invited to do a job for the university. A chap called Macfarlane in the West Indies, who was a graduate, had decided he would donate his astronomical instrument collection to the university to allow it to set up an observatory. So these Macfarlane instruments were heading across to Glasgow from the West Indies, and they needed someone. When they arrived, they weren't in very good shape, so they needed someone to repair these instruments and get them in working order so that they could be installed in the observatory. And someone must have said, oh, well, there's this young chap, James Watt, who's been studying instruments and has a lot of skill in that direction, so let's employ him. And that's what happened. He became mathematical instrument repairer initially. It was just a single job to start with, but I think he did such a good job that they decided they'd hire him on a permanent basis in an instrument maker role at the university.
The other thing he's doing during this period that I find fascinating is his civil engineering work, because, again, that's something that we think of nowadays as very specialized, requiring a lot of advanced knowledge. And yet, as you explain, he becomes a civil engineer. He's involved in these very high-profile engineering projects for the period.
Yes, well, the civil engineering really starts up when Watt concludes that his career as a merchant is not really going to satisfy him or provide the standard that he wants. By 1764, he's married and children are starting to come along. And his work at the university, whilst he's very much enjoyed it and it gave him a lot of stimulus scientifically and in various other ways, it wasn't really paying the bills, nor were the shops that he was trying to run in Glasgow. So, yes, he turned then to these larger engineering projects that were important in the development of Scotland at this time in the 1760s, 70s and beyond. Prominent among these was the development of canals, canal system. So Watt became essentially a canal engineer, surveying routes for canals. So the proprietors, the promoters of canals would decide that they wanted a canal from Glasgow to Edinburgh, and then an engineer would be employed to survey the route and try and find the best way to the best route for the canal. So he did spend a number of years from the mid-1760s into the 1770s in that kind of work. It involved him in being away from home a great deal, riding across the countryside on horseback with his surveying instruments. So Watt became an engineer in that sense. He also became, I think that was his preferred activity, actually, as a canal engineer. But to really make money, he found himself becoming also a construction engineer, that is to say, someone who actually took charge of building the canal. And that was a very different proposition. You know, that involved dealing with large groups of labourers, and the whole business side of construction, as well as negotiating things constantly with the proprietors who, you know, wanted the best value for their money. And whilst he did this, he did it particularly on a canal called the Monklands Canal, running from the Monklands coalfield outside Glasgow towards the city centre. Whilst he found this kind of work quite lucrative, he also found it very difficult. His temperament was not particularly suited to business dealings in the sense of bargaining. You know, face-to-face, toe-to-toe bargaining was something that Watt actually came to dread. And so he was always on the lookout for engineering jobs that really involved him either being in the field or in what they called the closet, that is to say, in his study. That's where Watt felt most at home.
I liked when you talked about this this part of his life, because you are also tying it to these misconceptions that we have about him. And as you explain, this is where this misconception, a lot of people refer to this when they get this misconception that he was simply bad at business. And yet, as you point out, it has a good amount to do with his health, which, as you describe, is never terribly robust, and how these things tended to foster into these misunderstandings about Watt's abilities and his preferences.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I may have given the impression in what I just said that Watt was not a good businessman. That's not true. He was very canny about money. He was very quick to see opportunities to make money. He was very quick to see technical solutions to problems that stood in the way of making money. It was really just a temperamental matter that the actual face-to-face bargaining was something that he found difficult. I think he found dealing with rough and tumble workmen also quite challenging. Yeah, there are many sort of mythologies about Watt, and certainly one of them is that he was a poor businessman and that he needed, therefore he needed good businessmen to work with. You know, we'll get to a couple of his partners in business. And very often, you know, they're seen as making up a deficiency that Watt has. I don't think they're actually making up a deficiency in business acumen. Really what they're making up most is a deficiency of capital. That is to say, he needed other people's money to pursue the ambitious projects that he ended up working on.
So what you've outlined here is a rising talent in uh, in uh, the in Scotland. He's involved in some big projects. And yet, it's around this time that he makes, it's soon after this time that he makes a move to Birmingham. And I was wondering if you could explain what it was that leads him to undertake this move, and how does it how does it change his life?
Okay, we haven't really talked about the elephant in the room yet, which is, of course, the steam engine. And it's the steam engine and the improvement of the steam engine that leads Watt to Birmingham eventually. He gets interested in steam whilst he's still at the University of Glasgow. A friend of his actually ends up making some suggestions about how to improve the existing type of steam engine, and Watt becomes interested in that, and he starts doing some chemical experiments, so some experiments on heat. Again, there's a story that he played with a model engine that one of the professors used in his classes to demonstrate, and it had broken down, and Watt was given the task of repairing this. Whether it's true or not, that he certainly did a lot of experimental work on heat and the production of steam and how this might be done more efficiently. And he detected a few problems with the so-called Newcomen engine, named after Thomas Newcomen, who developed the first viable steam engines in the early 18th century. So Watt develops this interest in the steam engine. It has to take really the back seat, or you might say put on the back burner, whilst he's earning all this money doing his canal projects. Because steam at that point is something that really consumes money rather than makes him money. He's not going to keep the food on the table for his kids. Watt does find a partner, though, who's prepared to put some money into this, a chap called John Roebuck, who is actually from Birmingham himself, but he's working in Scotland, pursuing various projects in Scotland, and he's associated with the Carron Ironworks in Scotland, which was quite important in providing some of the infrastructure that a developing industrial country needed. And Roebuck gets to know of Watt and thinks that there is some real promise in Watt's work on the steam engine. In the meantime, Watt has had a brilliant idea. Again, the story is that he had this idea when he was wandering on Glasgow Green one day. He was trying to figure out why it was that so much steam was wasted in Newcomen steam engines. And he concluded that one of the reasons for this was that in order for the steam engine to operate, the cylinder where the steam was injected had to be ended up being cooled down, because you had to inject cold water into the steam in order to create a vacuum, which then led the piston to drop in the engine. And this was rather inefficient in heat terms. So Watt's wandering across Glasgow Green, and as he reported many years later, and suddenly he had the idea for what became known as the separate condenser. Watt decided that if you could condense the steam in a chamber that was separate from the main cylinder but still connected to it, if you could inject the cold water into this separate chamber, then it would condense all the steam in that chamber and in the cylinder, but it wouldn't cool the cylinder down. So the engine would be able to operate at a higher temperature all the time, and Watt believed this would be much more efficient. So this is where Watt's at when he comes across John Robison. John Robison thinks this is a great idea. He wants to put some money in and invest in the scheme. He's the one actually who puts up the money for Watt to take out a patent on the separate condenser and on a number of other technical improvements. This is a patent that Watt takes out in 1769. It's actually the 250th anniversary of the separate condenser patent this year. Okay, so things are going okay with Robison for a little while. Watt's doing his experiments, trying to build a steam engine, making some progress. But then Robison gets into financial trouble. There's a big bank failure, a big financial crisis in Scotland in 1772 or thereabouts. And Robison's caught up in that, as are many people. And so he's basically going bankrupt. Watt sees the writing on the wall. He thinks, you know, getting the finance in Scotland to pursue my goals is not going to be easy. He's also has a tragedy in his life. While he's out on one of his canal projects, he gets a message that his wife, who was about to produce another child, was severely ill. And so he makes his way back to Glasgow, but a friend meets him on the road and gives him the sad news that his wife has died in childbirth. So here is Watt, just lost his wife. He has two young children who are dependent on him. And he has a failing steam engine business in Scotland. This is what leads him to go to Birmingham. He knew people in Birmingham. He had met them on trips down to London. He'd gone down to London on canal business and stopped in at Birmingham. He was always curious to see sort of other industrial towns and their industries. And he went there and he visited the manufactory of a gentleman called Matthew Bolton, who was a hardware manufacturer in Birmingham. Birmingham itself was a town known for its metal trades, or working with metal and producing all sorts of metal goods. And Bolton was what was known at the time as a toy manufacturer, which didn't mean that he, you know, produced model cars and that sort of thing for children. What it meant was he produced small metal items, belt buckles and the like. But he had a very large manufacturing operation. And Bolton himself was interested in power, in powering his own facilities. And so eventually when they met up, they saw a good deal of interest in each other. And Bolton was actually already trying to persuade Watt to come down to Birmingham before John Roebuck's business troubles really turned very bad. And so, yeah, when the crisis came in 1774, Watt decided that he would go down to Birmingham. He rescued the parts of his engine from a workshop that he had on John Roebuck's estate, and he took them to Birmingham. He left his children behind with some of his older female relatives, but he took his engine to Birmingham and tried to build his life there from that point on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, you've explained how you know what his innovations are and how they improve the steam engine. And he, in Birmingham, he works on it some more. But you explained that it wasn't enough simply to physically improve the engine. And this is another part of the book that I found very fascinating, which was how you explained how he was very cognizant of and the process that he went through to ensure that he and his partner would profit from the engine. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit that process as well, because it really gets to an aspect of this history that we don't often think about, which is this very, you know, sometimes very abstracted, very technical, but also very fascinating process of how to make money, how they make money from these inventions.
Yeah, well, indeed. I mean, this is the basic distinction, which is so important between invention and innovation. I mean, inventions can be thought up in a, you know, in a closed room, but they don't become an innovation. They don't make money. They don't become commercially viable. They don't have effects in the economy and the society unless somebody's prepared to invest in them, and they're not going to invest in them unless they're going to make money. Now, the basic route that Watt decided he would take in trying to make money from his steam inventions was by taking out a patent, the patent on the separate condenser. And he took out other patents too. But the basic mechanism of the patent is that it gives the patentee a limited period, in this case, 14 years nominally, during which they have they will have an exclusive right to exploit the invention that is specified in the patent. In return for that exclusive right, then they have to provide a specification of the invention. That is to say, they have to tell the world what the invention is and how it works, so that when the patent runs its course and comes to an end, that idea, that technology is available publicly. Now, when Watt went to Birmingham, unfortunately, he'd taken his patent out in 1769, and he went to Birmingham in 1774. He still hadn't got anywhere near a commercially viable engine at that point. And so before Boulton went into partnership with him, he really wanted to ensure that they could extend this patent. It was only 14 years. Five or six of those years had gone. And so what they did, and Boulton was very adept at this, they decided they would lobby Parliament, which was one way that you could get an act of Parliament, actually, to extend the patent. This was the first order of business then, so far as Boulton and Watt were concerned. They had to get this patent extended. They were successful. An Act of Parliament was passed in 1775, which extended their patent to the year 1800, which was a very generous extension and certainly gave them lots of time to exploit their invention. So what does the work? He gets a viable engine, and then he says, well, how are we going to actually make money out of this? I mean, one way would be to build engines and to sell them. But even Boulton with his manufacturing capabilities at that time, didn't really have the wherewithal to build complete steam engines. So what decided that the best way to make money would be to design steam engines, to license the design to people who wanted to use these engines, and then to charge those people a sum of money for the savings in fuel that the engine made possible. Right? This was the great thing about James Watt's engine with the separate condenser when compared with earlier steam engines. It was much more fuel efficient. And there were certain situations, especially in places like Cornwall, where fuel was scarce, coal was scarce. It was very expensive because it had to be transported there. There were no local supplies. So if you could provide an engine that was much, much more efficient and needed less less coal, then that was very attractive. And Watt decided that the way to make money themselves was to take a portion, a third was what they specified. It was to take a portion of the savings in fuel that the user of the steam engine managed to make.
Go ahead.
This was very astute, because of course the from the point of view of the person using the steam engine, they were getting quite a good deal. They weren't having to pay a lot of money up front. So far as they made money by the savings, the experience with the steam engine, then Boulton and Watt made money. So it looked like a very good way to make money out of Watt's patent. That's how they proceeded.
Who was using these steam engines, and how were they employing them? What did they need the power for?
Okay. Steam engines, even before Watt's time, were in use particularly to pump water out of mines. As coal mines and metal mines went deeper and deeper, you know, searching out seams deeper and deeper underground, the problem of flooding was a very difficult one. Existing steam engines, Newcomen engines, were certainly an improvement on earlier ways of pumping water out of mines, but they used a lot of fuel. And so Watt's initial market, the target market, if you like, for Boulton and Watt, were the copper and tin mines of Cornwall. Cornwall, as I've explained, was a place where it was very important to be fuel efficient. And so the Cornish were interested in, Cornish mine owners were interested in Boulton and Watt's engines for that reason. So in the late 1770s, this was the main market for their engines. I mean, I think their first steam engine was produced, their first pumping engine was actually produced for a colliery near Birmingham, in Dudley, near Birmingham, in 1776. And they also produced an engine for an ironworks, John Wilkinson's ironworks, which was also nearby. That was a blowing engine to operate a set of bellows. But these were sort of experimental engines. They worked locally to start with, cooperatively really with these users of their engines to perfect the machines, and then they moved on Cornwall.
So you mentioned that they did well from this. Exactly how well did Watt do as a result of this invention?
Yeah, well, this struck me as an interesting line to pursue, an interesting question to pursue, because Watt has often been portrayed as a kind of otherworldly inventor and natural philosopher. But he was actually inordinately interested in money. Watt was known for his headaches in his youth. You know, he used to suffer quite badly from headaches and probably from what we would call depression. But there was a time when his second wife, actually was talking to one of Watt's old friends in Glasgow, and the old friend ventured the opinion that James would get over his headaches when he got rich. that, in fact, does seem to have been the case. Watt made a good deal of money out of his engines by the time he retired in 1800. It's quite difficult to figure out exactly how much. In his will, he left a will that was worth more than £60,000, which is, you know, much more money than it sounds these days. back then. So I tried to actually reconstruct the amount of money that Watt might have made by looking at, you know, the engines, the large number of engines that Boulton and Watt operated in Cornwall and then in other places, and the amount of money that they should have raked in on these fuel savings. It's difficult because, you know, people didn't always pay up. Boulton and Watt in hard economic times sometimes, you know, soft pedaled the pressure on the payments. So it's hard to figure out exactly. But my guess was that Watt probably took in from that business by 1800 somewhere between 100 and 150,000 pounds. That was his share, which is a very substantial fortune. And in fact, he did spend a lot of money buying land, in particular in the Welsh borders. He became something of a landed gentleman in his retirement. This was very common among the rising business class. You know, they would make their money in business and then invest in land, which was still regarded as, you know, the prime asset. And of course, land was what the socially superior sectors of the population owned and lived off. So Watt became a very wealthy man.
You quote a couple times in the book before Watt became wealthy about how his vision for when he would gain a fortune would be that he could basically engage in experimentation and discovery full time. And that gets to an aspect of his life that we haven't really discussed in as much detail, which is the scientific innovations, because he was more than just an engineer and an inventor. He was also a person that was engaged in scientific inquiry, a lot of which was tied to the engineering. But as you explain, it was, you know, there was also a lot of theoretical work being undertaken by him at this time.
Yes, I mean, even from his school days, Watt had a tremendous interest in natural philosophy, in science, in chemistry in particular. This was reinforced when he was a mathematical instrument maker at the University of Glasgow. Some of the professors there adopted him, Professor Joseph Black, who was a famous chemist and had discovered what we call carbon dioxide. Professor Anderson at Glasgow University, who was more of a what we would call a physicist, also encouraged Watt as well. So he learned a great deal at the University of Glasgow. But he experimented incessantly himself. He always, it seems, had a laboratory. You know, when he lived in fairly humble circumstances in Glasgow, he always had some kind of garret workshop where he did chemical experiments, among other things. When he gets to Birmingham, Watt moves in a circle who are very strongly interested in natural philosophy. This is a group known as the Lunar Society. Matthew Boulton was a member of the Lunar Society, a very famous chemist called Joseph Priestley also became a member of the Lunar Society. Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather, was a member of the Lunar Society. So Watt began to move in that circle, and that reinforced his scientific interests. As you say, a lot of his experimentation was done in connection with the steam engine and with other projects. He was involved in pottery, a pottery manufacturer back in Glasgow, and he did experiments on glazes and different kinds of clay and so on. So a lot of his experiments were business orientated, but he did tend to experiment far beyond the requirements of any given project. You know, he got interested in the subject matter and pursued it really much further than he needed to, just for business purposes. And this led him to what became his only really really famous claim to a scientific discovery. And this was the discovery of the composition of water. Water through most of the 18th century was regarded as an element, as the ancients had regarded water as an element. But there were a number of people working on what we would call gases, they called airs, in the 1760s and 1770s, 1780s. What came up, he wasn't the only person to do this, but he was one of the people who came up with the idea in the 1780s that water was a compound. Essentially, it was a compound of two airs, inflammable air, which we call hydrogen, and dephlogisticated air, which we call oxygen. It was more complicated because Watt actually believed that heat was a substance and that heat was also a crucial, perhaps the crucial, substance that was combined with inflammable air and dephlogisticated air to produce water. But anyway, in the early 1780s, he's working on these experiments, and he's encouraged by Joseph Priestley, who he's become very friendly with, and by others in his circle, to actually write this work up and to submit it to the Royal Society of London, which he does. And he publishes a two-part paper in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society in 1784. And this, as I say, is the only scientific work of Watt's that most people know anything about or knew anything about. There was a lot of activities, like the duck on the pond. You know, there's a great deal of activity going on underneath. Watt's actually doing a lot more scientific work and experimentation than is apparent from his published work. Most of it. You can only find out about it by reading his correspondence, which is what I've done in order to find out about his extensive philosophical investigations.
We're also at a point in his life where he has this this growing stature. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about his reputation, his standing in the country, and what that it, and how he responded to that, and how he dealt with that.
Yes, okay. In a way, Watt's stature and his reputation had been very important to him and to the business of Boulton and Watt from the beginning. We know that in the later years of his life, say from about 1800 until his death in 1819, Watt becomes a celebrated individual. His legend is developed. And the legend is involves, among other things, the idea that he is a very accomplished philosopher and scientific experimenter. But in fact, he'd been encouraged in that view of himself right from the beginning with the steam engine business. When you take out a patent, I mean, whoever's been involved in developing the ideas in the patent, somebody has to be credited with it. And it was always Watt in the Boulton and Watt business. The patents were always in Watt's name. And as the business grew, Watt was not the only inventor in the business. Not the only productive person in that sense, but the work of the other inventors, collaborators with Boulton and Watt, was not recognised in the patents. There was a sort of a company policy, if you like, that all the philosophical credit went in Watt's direction, and the patents were in his name. There was a good reason for this. That again, right from the beginning, the fact that their steam engines were based on science, on extensive experimentation, was one of the main selling points that they used in promoting their engines. You know, these are not the product of sort of empirical tinkering by ordinary mechanics, but they are the product of high-level scientific experimentation by James Watt, who, of course, is a great philosopher. And so Watt had, I suppose, become used during this time to being given credit. He was in some ways a fairly retiring individual. He was quite dour, timid in some respects, but he'd certainly come to value reputation and saw the importance of reputation to business. In the 1790s, when they were fighting a lot of legal battles over their patents with people who were, you know, trying to circumvent them. Again, that was a time when in courts of law, many people, fellows of the Royal Society who they knew and other prominent people were turning up saying what a great guy Watt was, what a terrific philosopher he was, how his experimental work made their engines so much more superior. And of course, these rude mechanics who were pinching his ideas could never have come up with them themselves. So there's that kind of boost to the reputation in the 1790s. And when Watt retires, this process continues. He's showered with honours, an honorary Doctor of Laws from the University of Glasgow. He's even offered, towards the end of his life, a baronetcy. That is to say, he was offered the opportunity to become Sir James Watt, and for his eldest son, who was also called James Watt, to succeed to the baronetcy after him. That's something that he actually turned down. And I think he turned it down because he did have severe reservations about hereditary aristocracy from a social and an economic point of view. He was not an admirer of the economic contribution of hereditary aristocracy to the country. But anyway, so Watt's reputation is very important to him. He becomes something of a legend in his later years. And this is something that that his son begins to help him with, particularly in the 1790s. If people know about when you hear the stories of Charles Darwin's life, there's a chap called Thomas Huxley often comes up, and Huxley is known as Darwin's bulldog. That is to say, you know, Huxley always went into battle for Darwin and his ideas, and to make sure that Darwin got the credit that they both considered he was due. Well, in Watt's case, his son, James Watt Jr., was James Watt's bulldog.
And I have to say that actually was one of the most interesting parts of the book, because a lot of biographies, they stop usually with the subject's death, but you proceed in the final part of your book to trace that the evolution of that image over the next two centuries, how his son becomes the bulldog, and then how Watt comes to be remembered. It really is a fascinating tale because it ties back to the beginning of your book when you are talking about the difference between the myth of James Watt versus the reality that we have in the records, and then how that myth emerges not just during Watt's lifetime but afterward, as Britain becomes this mighty manufacturing power for which Watt receives a lot of credit, and as you point out at the very end of the book, in retrospect as well, some blame.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, the book's called The Life and Legend of James Watt, and that might give the impression that you can sort of tell the life, and then you can look at the legend subsequently and separately. But one of my key contentions in the book is that it's a mistake to do that. That the legend, I've already indicated this in a way when I'm talking about the way his reputation was important to the business, but his legend was very much part of the construction of the life. And in many ways, getting the life, getting to the life, and getting what I think is a reasonable characterization of Watt and his work, requires that you get behind the legend. It's very hard to get behind the legend because in the 19th, most of the sources that we use, most of the books that have been written about Watt and the articles that have been written about him, are in fact part of the construction of the legend, and the same sort of mythologies get repeated and repeated time after time. I mean, Watt died in 1819. He was already a very well-known figure. But already in the 1820s, by 1824, there's a public meeting which has the goal of raising funds to produce a statue which will be placed in Westminster Abbey to commemorate Watt. So very, very rapidly, people are, you know, putting Watt on a par with scientists like Newton, you know, who Isaac Newton, who had a statue in Westminster Abbey. And I think this is partly has to do with the rise of the commercial and business class in British society. Of course, after the French Wars and the famous victory of Wellington at Waterloo, military heroes are very, very important in Britain at that time, and statues are going up all over the place to military heroes. But the business classes are to some extent suspicious of that activity. You know, they think, well, look, the prosperity of this country certainly depends to some extent on, you know, its military defense and so on, but it also depends on industry and on technology, you know, on the people who enable industry to grow and develop and make us more and more money. So we need other sorts of heroes apart from military heroes. And I think this was a good deal of the impetus behind the idea of commemorating Watt's achievements by doing things like putting statues all over the place. By the end of the 19th century, there were numerous statues around the British Isles, you know, ranging from Oxford University to Greenock to Leeds to Manchester, London, Glasgow, Edinburgh. And Westminster Abbey, they were all over the place. So there's the reputation gets tied up with, in many ways, the British sense of, you know, their economic story, the story of the island. Britain, of course, undergoes an industrial revolution. In fact, Watt's activities are often seen as helping to precipitate that industrial revolution, and Britain becomes enormously powerful economically. And the stories that people tell about why that happened, how it happened, come to include quite prominently the story of James Watt. In the 20th century, in some ways, he becomes somewhat less famous, or less specifically famous. He's still famous as an inventor. The stories about him, you know, fiddling with a tea kettle when he's a child, which supposedly prefigured his mature accomplishments, those stories become widespread. He becomes a more general symbol of the inventor in the 20th century. But, of course, steam power has its competition, first from electricity and then from nuclear energy, so, and there are heroes of those sources of energy too. So Watt as a figure perhaps begins to decline in the 20th century. I know I obviously talk to people about my work occasionally at dinner parties and so on, and it's surprising how many people think that James Watt invented the light bulb. They think that because of course he the unit of energy the watt was named after him in the late 19th century, and so that's where most people come across come across the term. You know, the light goes out in the shed and they put a new one in and they say, oh, well, this is a 75 watt bulb. I know that's a little old fashioned now, or 11 lumens or whatever it is. The true stories about what's life have become a little less prominent in recent decades. And of course, there are other things that have happened to his reputation. They've always been detractors, actually, people who thought that Watt wasn't such a great guy. And they go back to his competitors in the steam engine business in the late 18th century. There is, in fact, a case to be made that, you know, Watt's views, his influence, so far as steam was concerned, were not always positive. All Watt's steam engines were low-pressure engines. That is, they operated at rather low steam pressures. And the steam technologies of the 19th century depended very strongly on high-pressure steam, and most obviously the railways. But also mature steamship technology relied on very high pressure engines. And as high pressure steam began to be suggested in the very late 18th century, Watt was strongly opposed. I mean, he was opposed partly for business reasons. So this is not what we do. This is not what we do. You know, we want to sell our low pressure engines, so we have to oppose high pressure steam.
Yeah,
but he also.
I was thinking about the current wars.
Sorry?
I was reading that section. I was thinking about the current wars that would follow between Edison and Westinghouse. You know, you have one person who's very wedded to the technology that he developed and how he is very resistant to the option of the new technology, which ends up becoming the norm after he's gone.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And certainly something similar went on between low pressure and high pressure steam. But of course, then the irony is that Watt's reputation becomes such in the 19th century that people tend to credit him with absolutely everything that happens in steam in the 19th century. So he gets credit. You know, people who don't say that Watt invented the light bulb might well say that he invented the steam locomotive. Because the tendency was to give Watt credit for everything that followed. In terms of steam power and steam traction. Yeah, but he, yeah, if it had been up to Watt, there would have been no railways.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, well, I must confess in recent months, I've been taking a little bit of a break. This project did take quite a lot out of me. But I am beginning to revive some projects that I'd thought about before. One concerns the nature of discovery and invention. One of the previous books I wrote that featured James Watt considerably was called Discovering Water. And I mentioned that he was a candidate discovery for the compound nature of water. There was actually a big controversy in the 19th century about who was the real discoverer. Was it Watt, or was it Antoine Lavoisier, the great French chemist, or was it in fact an English aristocrat called Henry Cavendish? So I wrote this book called Discovering Water, which looked at that controversy. And I'm thinking now of writing a much more general book about the nature of discovery and the nature of invention. They're usually thought of as psychological things, you know, literally the light bulb going off in somebody's head. You know, that's how discoveries happen. But there is a wider sense in which discoveries and inventions are both sort of the products of social processes that people get credited with discoveries and inventions. And how does that come about? You know, it's not, there might be many people with light bulbs going off in their heads, but why do some of them get credited with the invention and not others? So that's one of my thoughts, and another project I'm beginning to work on sort of comes out of this in a way. Two obscure characters who worked for Boulton and Watt erecting engines in the 1770s who were sympathetic with the American Revolution and ended up leaving for the United States and taking their steam engine knowledge with them, and in fact also taking a number of drawings and plans from Boulton and Watt to the American colonies. So that's a story of industrial espionage that I think will keep me amused for the next few years.
They both sound like fascinating projects. I look forward to reading them.
Okay.
Well, David,
you'll give me some incentive to keep trying to write them then.
Well, David Miller, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Mark. You too.